This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Part of the appeal of pro football has always been bone-jarring hits delivered on quarterbacks, receivers, and running backs. But as four teams battle Sunday for a trip to the Super Bowl, there will almost certainly be fewer headshots than in past years. That's because the league has finally made and enforced rule changes aimed at reducing head trauma. Players are now fined tens of thousands of dollars for leading with their helmets and tackles, and teams are banned from sending players with concussion symptoms back into games or practice. One of the agents of those changes is our guest, Christopher Nowinski. When he was a defensive lineman at Harvard, like others, he thought players who complained about head injuries were soft. But after suffering further concussions as a pro wrestler, he became an advocate for safer competition. In 2006, he wrote the book Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis, and he co-founded the Sports Legacy Institute, a nonprofit focused on concussions in sports. Part of Nowinski's work has involved convincing families of deceased former players to give him the athlete's brains so they could be studied for evidence of head trauma. Nowinski says there's been progress in protecting athletes, but as you'll hear, he thinks far more can be done, especially in youth football. I spoke to Christopher Nowinski yesterday. Well, Christopher Nowinski, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk about your own experience first. You played football at Harvard. You were an all-Ivy League lineman, right?
That's correct.
Do you know if you suffered concussions playing in college?
I believe I suffered two very minor ones, and they were not diagnosed at the time because, of course, I never said anything to anybody. But the one I remember most vividly was actually an inter-squad scrimmage before the season, I think my junior year. And I was in the back wall on the kick return team, and we had some bad kickers back in that day. And I unfortunately kicked the ball to me, and I was never allowed to touch it when I played football as a lineman. So I didn't know what to do except for run forward and put my head down. And I went helmet to helmet against one of our most vicious tacklers and didn't remember falling down. And I remember when the sky, when I opened my eyes, the sky had gone from blue to orange. And that was a significant difference, I think, for me. But, of course, I just kept on playing through it and then pieced together what exactly happened when I watched the film the next day and saw that we both found out we both got knocked silly and just kind of fell sideways, and it wasn't nearly as cool of a collision as I thought.
Wow. Was anybody talking about, you know, head injuries and concussions back then?
Not in any serious way. You know, we'd heard, you know, I started college in 96, and 94 was when Troy Aikman and Steve Young had those concussion issues, and that was kind of a early blip on this issue. But there was never really a context as to what, you know, what mattered about concussions and why it was a big deal that Troy Aikman suffered, you know, 10 concussions. And so I remember thinking that the teammates that I knew that got concussions, I was one of those guys who thought they were soft and that there was something wrong with them.
So you get out of Harvard and then end up with a pro wrestling career at World Wrestling Entertainment. Tell us a little about your persona as a wrestler.
I got to have a lot of fun by being a snobby Ivy League graduate. I happened to pre-WWE, I was on a reality television show called Tough Enough, and there were two Chrises on the show. And so that was back in the day they didn't use last names, and so they started calling me Chris Harvard. And once I was called Chris Harvard, I was immediately going to be a bad guy. And so I would travel the world insulting the fans and insulting my opponents and, you know, say things like when we went to Iowa State University, and I said, you know, Harvard and Iowa State have a lot in common. You know, Harvard has lots of Rhodes Scholars, and Iowa State has lots of dirt roads. And, yeah, it was just a blast.
Went over big, I guess.
Oh, huge.
Well, you know, we've got a little piece of sound from your days back in the ring, and I thought we'd listen to this. I don't know where this is, but this is you with a microphone talking to the crowd in the center of the ring and doing your act. And we should say that you come out and you wear red shorts with a Harvard H across your rear end, right?
That is correct.
And so in this clip, we'll hear you talking to the audience, and then we've got some TV announcers sort of chirping in and reacting to you. Let's listen.
Ever since I made my debut in the WWE, I've been perplexed as to why you people seem to hate me. Just because I'm a Harvard graduate.
Right. You ever heard that word before, Jared? Perplexed?
Yes, I'm a Harvard.
You people should be grateful to have someone of my intelligence in your presence.
Exactly.
Has anything to do with Harvard?
It's an honor.
But I understand why you people can't relate to a guy like me. Because after all, I am a Harvard graduate.
Right! We understand that. Get it there, graduate.
Well, that seems like more fun than graduate school.
Those were the days.
And of course, you were the foil. You were the guy that folks loved to hate because you were this Ivy League snob. But you did get in the ring and you mixed it up. What kind of headshots did you take?
I took quite a few. Of course, wrestling is meant to be predetermined, and you're not supposed to injure your opponent. But the reality is the moves are so fast, and most of the matches are improvised. There's a very small margin for error, and so I got 4 concussions while I was wrestling, and a few of them were from kicks to the head. Just the fact that I'm running full speed across the ring, and one of them, Bubba Ray Dudley's, giving me kicking me in the head with a straight leg, and we were just 6 inches closer than we thought, and he was trying to make it look good, and so he just knocked me silly. Another time, somebody was giving me a move called an enziguri, where they kicked me in the back of the head, and the sound you usually hear is the person slapping their hip while they do it, but in this one, my friend Simon Dean later told me he thought he broke his foot. So, I got unlucky in a number of nights, and it was rough.
And what symptoms did you experience, and do you still experience?
Well, at the time he kicked me, I remember we were in the Hartford Civic Center, and I hit my back, and I remember looking up at the ceiling of the arena and realizing that I just had no idea where I was, and I had no idea what we were doing out there. I couldn't remember what happened before. I couldn't remember what was supposed to happen next. And it was a very scary feeling to be out in front of 5,000 fans with it was a tag team match, 3 guys moving around you at full speed, and just being completely felt like I was just dropped in on the situation. So we ended up finishing the match. They just would tell me what to do move for move because I had the memory of a goldfish. And when I got backstage, I just remember my head just pounding and pounding and pounding. And the athletic trainer would come out to see, you could tell something was wrong. But the first thing I said was, I'm fine, leave me alone. And I just, I actually went and disappeared and hid in the bowels of the arena, laying on the floor to try to cool off my head. And as time went on, I ended up essentially, I didn't know any better that you're supposed to rest a concussion after you get it. So I ended up wrestling or working out every day for 5 weeks. And made the symptoms worse and brought on new ones. I developed short-term memory problems. It started with not being able to remember the matches as I was going out there and actually planning a couple of matches at the end with plan Bs, saying, if I blank out there, let's do XYZ. And then what really, made me stop was the fact that we did a show. We went from Green Bay to Indianapolis. I'm driving from Indianapolis to our show that night in Terre Haute. Apparently, I'm going in and out of normalcy and consciousness or something, where my driving partner, unbeknownst to me, though he's sitting next to me, called ahead to the managers of that show saying, don't let Chris wrestle. There's something wrong with him. So I show up, and they say, we're giving you the night off. So I don't wrestle. I go back to Indianapolis to get ready for the next show, and I go to bed. My girlfriend happened to be on the road with me at the time, and I woke up. Apparently about an hour after I went to bed, on the floor of the hotel room, surrounded by a broken nightstand and a broken lamp. My girlfriend told me that I had started acting out my dream, and so I stood up on the bed at one point. She couldn't wake me up. She couldn't pull me down. And I, in my dream, I guess I thought I saw something falling, and I jumped for it and just went head first into the wall and through the nightstand. And apparently even hitting the ground didn't wake me up. It took about 30 seconds. And that's really what scared me straight and said, geez, I think there's something wrong with my brain and I should get checked out. And I never wrestled again.
So tell us about this becoming not just a personal issue, but, a crusade for you.
My eyes were opened when I was traveling from doctor to doctor to try to really understand what was going on inside my head. And nobody could help me understand why suddenly one kick to the head is causing all these problems. Finally, at doctor number 8 was a gentleman named Dr. Robert Cantu, who became my co-founder of SLI and became my mentor. But at the time, he was my my concussion doctor, a neurosurgeon. And when I went into his office, he said, "How many concussions have you had?" And I said, "Well, I've had zero." And that's what I'd told the other seven doctors. I'd never been diagnosed with a concussion. And he said, "Okay, well, I appreciate that, but how many times have you been hit in the head and you've seen stars or got double vision or felt nauseous or got confused and dizzy?" And I was like, "Well, doc, those happen all the time. That's just a ding." And he was like, "Well, that's actually, they're all concussions, whether or not you're knocked out, and maybe you've had too many." And that's how I kind of pieced together my concussion history of six in the previous 5 years. And then, you know, he started just sharing all this other information, you know, talking about, you know, I couldn't believe, A, I didn't know what a concussion was. And B, he told me, had I rested the concussion and not fought through those 5 weeks, that I would have really probably been fine, that a concussion itself is not necessarily a huge problem, but when you return to play too soon and keep stressing an injured brain, that's really the problem. And so I realized that I'd really thrown my career away and a few years of my life out of just, you know, plain old ignorance. And then on my own, I happened to have a life prior to wrestling as a life sciences consultant for a company called Trinity Partners outside of Boston. And I decided to read every study ever published on traumatic brain injury and concussion and what the consequences are. And it helped me realize that what people really didn't appreciate in the medical world was how many concussions were actually happening. There were a ton of studies out there that talked about the fact that 5% of football players or hockey players or soccer players each year were diagnosed with a concussion. But there were a small group of studies that actually asked the players, well, you know, because you don't tell an athletic trainer when you have a concussion because, A, you don't want to come out, and B, you don't really even know you have the injury. The studies that asked the players directly, it wasn't 5% who had concussions, it was 50% each year. So one out of every two players in a football field got dinged each year. And if that was truly the case, then we did not have a handle on the situation at all.
So in 2006, you wrote the book, Head Games. And I'd like you to tell us the story of Andre Waters and your involvement with him.
Right. So I put all that information into Head Games. And then a month after the book came out, I read about Andre Waters committing suicide. He was a strong safety for the Philadelphia Eagles and a guy that I grew up watching in great battles with the Chicago Bears. So in the book, in Chapter 4, I profiled a medical examiner named Bennett Amalu, who had studied the brains of two Pittsburgh Steelers who had died in Allegheny County where he worked, and decided to take a look inside their brains to see if the symptoms that they'd shown throughout their lives, and they both struggled mightily in their 40s, before dying young, may have been correlated to the disease chronic traumatic encephalopathy, also known as dementia pugilistic or punch drunk disease. Apparently, nobody had ever looked for this disease in a former football player. Even though it was widely known in boxing, nobody ever pieced together that football players might be at risk as well. So, Mike Webster really struggled, was homeless, and suffered from dementia.
He was the center for the Chicago Bears, right?
Yeah. He was the center for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
The Steelers, okay. Right.
Yep. He was a Hall of Famer, probably the best center to ever play the game. And then Terry Long was another offensive lineman for the Steelers who had committed suicide and had shown very bizarre behaviors in the last few years of his life, including, he burned down his chicken processing plant for the insurance money, just prior. So because Long committed suicide at about the same age, I thought, you know, I bet you Andre Waters, because he was known as Dirty Waters for being a big hitter with his head, had a lot of concussions, and I wonder if the concussions led to the disease and the disease contributed to the suicide. And so I Googled Andre Waters' concussion history and found that he was quoted in 1994 saying that he stopped counting his concussions at 15 and he would just grab smelling salts and keep playing. So I knew that if anyone was at high risk for CTE, it was Andre. And so I decided to call his family and ask if they would let Dr. Marlow study Andre's brain.
Yeah, this is sort of a remarkable part of the story. You figured you got to look at his brain, you call and asked, and where was his brain?
His brain was with the medical examiner. The medical examiner, in cases where people die in unusual circumstances, they retain tissue and blood and some other things. And so he'd retained five parts of Andre's brain. And so, and I actually asked the medical examiner first if he was doing the studies. I kind of naively assumed that the medical examiner have some interest as to the cause of the suicide. And, you know, I remember the medical examiner telling me, yes, I know the cause of the suicide. He shot himself in the cause of death. He shot himself in the head. And so he wasn't interested in seeing any underlying issues. And so he was the one who actually told me that if I had the family's permission, that he couldn't stop me from having the studies done. And so I tracked down his family and I laid it out to him. I said, I think the brain trauma might have contributed. We can find out, and the findings will go a long way towards making this game safer for the next generation.
And so when it was Dr. O'Malley, you said, when he examined Andre Waters' brain, what did he discover?
He discovered that Andre Waters was the third of three former NFL players who all died by the age of 50 who had CTE. And, you know, considering the fact that prior to this, when people thought, you know, what are the odds of someone getting CTE, they really talked in terms of one in a million. To go for the three for three in this very select club was shocking. And it did not bode well for people who played a lot of football.
So a movement got underway. I mean, you and some others formed this group, the Sports Legacy Institute, and started raising this issue, both with the media, with the league. How did the rest of football react?
Football did not react well at the beginning, unfortunately. The football community, whether you're talking NFL, college, youth, they saw this as a threat to the game and as an unnecessary nuisance. And people just did not want to have this conversation. I mean, you know, not just belittling it in the media and saying this isn't a real thing. It's just anecdotal evidence. It's people practicing bad science. I mean, those things were all said. But also just people were annoyed. I remember I had a good friend whose good friend was a coach in the NFL who I said, I'd like to speak with you. I'd like to share you this information. And the message was passed to me to stop messing around with the game. It kind of fell on deaf ears there for a while.
You know, and I think one of the things that really got people's attention were some really heartbreaking stories about players who hadn't died, but who'd really lost a lot of memory and cognitive function. You want to talk about one of those folks and the impact they had?
Sure. Well, the person who really became a face for this was a former New England Patriots middle linebacker, Ted Johnson. Ted had been introduced to me actually in 06, before Andre Waters, by a mutual friend who said, Ted retired from concussions I think at the end of the 04 season. And had since gone on a pretty strong downward spiral to the point where he was abusing amphetamines. He was, his marriage was falling apart. At times, he wasn't leaving his house for days. No one could ever get a hold of him. It was really a bad place. And he said, "Can you help Ted out?" And so I went out to Ted's house and I sat down with him and I said, talk to me, what's going on? He told me his symptoms, and I said, I have the same thing. And he said, what's it called? I'm like, we have post-concussion syndrome. And he was like, I've never heard that phrase before. And apparently Ted had no understanding of that the concussions he suffered could be contributing to the problems he had that day. And Ted had a very public problem. He'd gotten a concussion in a Patriots game. And Bill Belichick put him back in practice, in live practice, 2 days later against
the Patriots. That was the head
orders.
Coach, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the head coach of the Patriots put Ted back in, and Ted got another concussion 2 days after the first, and he said he's never been the same guy since. And so, Ted actually had agreed to write the introduction to my book because I figured that would help people take it seriously, and he actually wrote it, and it was all ready to go to the printer, and then his family requested that he withdraw it because he didn't want to be seen. They didn't want him seen as someone with brain damage because that would hurt his ability to make a living the rest of his life. So he pulled out. We didn't talk for a little while, and then when Andre committed suicide, and then the story came out by Alan Schwartz on the front page of the New York Times, I actually brought the Times over to Ted's apartment and before we went out to dinner, and I said, "Ted, this happened because guys don't know the name for what they're feeling, and if you came forward, you could make a huge difference." And you know, he accepted that challenge and he went public with his story, and things were never the same.
You've talked about some really tragic cases where former players who apparently had CTE, this chronic traumatic injury, killed themselves. What are the symptoms before it reaches that point? Someone who gets advanced chronic traumatic encephalopathy, what do they experience?
The symptoms you see at the beginning of chronic traumatic encephalopathy are it starts a lot with short-term memory problems and then overall memory problems. It starts a lot with impulse control issues. And so you don't have control of your behaviors, things you say, things you do, which leads to behavioral problems. And then you combine mood disorders like depression. And so and all that often leads to personality change. And so you're really focused on memory, cognition, emotion, and mood. All of those things will change dramatically. And what that becomes is that players who have had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, many of them have committed suicide. Many of them have developed drug and alcohol abuse issues. A lot of them were actually self-medicating through headaches, didn't have any impulse control issues, so would get addicted to things. You have very bizarre behaviors. Justin Strelzik was hearing voices before and giving away money on the streets and became hyper-religious before leading the police on a 40-mile chase where he went through the windshield and died. And I think the worst example would be Chris Benoit. Not an NFL player, but Chris Benoit was my colleague with World Wrestling Entertainment, who in 2007, after being one of the most respected guys in WWE, decided to wake up one day and kill his wife, kill a 7-year-old son, and hang himself. And his brain was very progressed with CTE. And so, it's really an ugly disease.
Well, as you and others raised the issue of head injuries in football, it sort of came to a boil in 2009. And for a long time, the National Football League didn't really acknowledge that there was scientific evidence that repeated concussions was having impacts on their players. But they turned around and they began to make some changes. Let's talk about them. One of them had to do with keeping players off the field who've had a concussion. What did they do?
Yeah, in November, December of 2009, after a pretty ugly congressional hearing for them, the NFL saw the light and decided to make some pretty dramatic changes to their policies on how they treated head injuries. And one of them was that athletes were no longer allowed to return back to a game when they were symptomatic, symptomatic from a concussion. Prior to this, famous examples, 2005, when Wayne Corbett, New York Jets wide receiver, was knocked unconscious on the field for a minute. And the Jets team doctor happened to be the head of the NFL's concussion committee and thought it was a good idea to let Wayne go back into the game 10 minutes later. And, of course, Wayne retired from the game from post-concussion syndrome at the end of the season, but no one ever pieced those two things together. And so that practice was now going to be stopped, to the benefit of a lot of players.
And in your impression as you watch the game, is it being enforced? Are they keeping guys out of the game when they should?
But they're getting better at it. I think at the end of the season, I think we saw it happening very, very consistently. There were some striking examples at the beginning of the season that the policy wasn't exactly working. I think the best example being a Philadelphia Eagles game early in the year where Kevin Cobb first got a concussion. And when he went to the sideline to be evaluated, Stuart Bradley got another one for the Eagles and actually fell over trying to get to the sideline. And clearly, to anybody, he clearly had a concussion. But apparently no one from the Eagles medical staff was watching the game because they were all with Cobb and didn't see it. And no one on the coaching staff or the players thought they should alert them to it. And so Stuart Bradley found himself back in the game 4 minutes after falling over, after a hit to the head, and which was just horrifying and shocking. And everybody in the entire world watching that game knew he was concussed and shouldn't be in there, but the Eagles didn't handle it. And so, what was great about it, it became a media event. And I realized based on the reaction to it, the mood had changed, and that was never going to happen again because someone knew they were going to lose their job. But, of course, Kevin Cobb even went back into that game. Okay. So it got better at the end of the year.
Now, they've also changed the rules and their enforcement of rules about vicious hits. You can't lead with your helmet now, right? And you can't hit a defenseless player, that is to guess someone who's sort of open to contact. You can't hit them with your helmet, what, your forearm or the pads,
or
right?
Shoulder
pads.
Right, right.
And is that working?
You know, that's working to diminish the biggest hits in the game. You know, the issue is that, you know, as helmets have gotten better, you know, players have found it's very effective to use them as a weapon, and it's exactly how you can deliver the most force to somebody, and you can easily knock somebody out if they don't see it coming. Well, you know, that was, you know, while it might be an effective strategy, it was extraordinarily dangerous for the players, and in the rule book, it was actually, you know, technically illegal, but was never being enforced, and so the NFL stepped up and said, okay, we're going to eliminate these really vicious helmet-to-helmet hits on defenseless players, and you know, it has clearly changed the way the game was played. And I even heard rumors that scoring was up this year because receivers were no longer as fearful to run across the middle. It's one thing to get the wind knocked out of you. I think we're bringing that back. But to get knocked out to catch a 5-yard pass across the middle is never worth it. So it's been remarkable to see how quickly the players adjusted and have gone back to better tackling techniques. But, you know, the reality is, while that's a great change, it's certainly not going to solve the problem in any major way by itself. I mean, we're eliminating a few dozen hits from the league each year out of hundreds of thousands. And so the bigger change that needs to be made is dramatically reducing actually how we practice this game. Studies show that 75% of the hits to the head a player will take happen in practice when no one's keeping score. And having played and practiced and talked to guys who've played, no one really enjoys the hitting in practice. And if we found out that it's this bad for you, we really should almost eliminate it from practice. Just hit as much as it takes to be safe, but then save the hits for the games. If we did that, we would lower everyone's exposure tomorrow by 50% and maybe even higher.
And coaches, and that's I assume coaches want people to hit in practice because they feel they're better prepared for the game, right?
Some coaches do. The fact is that there's a few great examples of programs who never hit, like St. Joseph's in Minnesota, who is a D3 national champion almost every few years. They never hit in practice. The fact is when you talk to programs, hitting in practice is not really correlated to winning. It's just kind of a mindset that people have that if you're not doing well, you hit more. If you win, you say it's because you hit more. It's an easy out. Coaches are scared to be that program that if you never hit in practice, then you start losing. People will say it's because you guys are soft. But we're trying this model in different places. We actually worked with the Sports Legacy Institute worked with a youth football league in Westport, Connecticut, the Westport Police Athletic League. We laid out all the research and everything we knew, and we said, look, these are the changes you have to make, and it really starts with how you practice. They went from 30 concussions 3 years ago to 25 last year to 11 this year and still won their league.
Right. But the issue for really is subconcussive of impacts, really, right? I mean, you want them to –
right.
It's the repetitive hits that aren't concussions that you're really concerned about here, right?
Right. The repetitive hits that don't cause concussions are the ones that – you know, there's just so many of them, and that's what we need to focus on right now to eliminate. Because by eliminating just overall hits to the head, you're also going to dramatically reduce concussions. And so, that's what the conversation we need to have, and that's the conversation we're pushing. And even from the NFL and NFLPA perspective, if you want to make NFL players less likely to get CTE, it's not changing the game they're playing today, because the average NFL player plays only 3 years. The reality is you want to change the 10 years they played prior to the NFL, recognize the fact that they're doing most of this as children, and dramatically reduce the exposure they have to brain trauma.
You know, one thing I never quite understood about you know, helmet-to-helmet hits is that a player who – isn't a player who leads with his helmet in a hit absorbing just as much punishment as he is inflicting?
No, actually, it's kind of the way the physics works out. It's more like a game of chicken. If you come into that hit with more force than your opponent, you'll almost always push them backwards, and therefore your brain doesn't slow down as abruptly as theirs does. And therefore, you're almost certainly fine. There are rare situations where the forces are so great that both guys are concussed. But my recollection is if I brought more force into the hit, I wouldn't feel a thing. It actually felt really good. And so if that's the case, it's a game of chicken because you're both better off if you don't hit each other as hard as you can helmet to helmet. But the reality is if you win the battle, you're fine. And so everyone just tries to win the battle, and that's why we get these enormous collisions.
Yeah, long ago coaches used to use the expression for good blocking, put a hat on somebody. But you know, it's one of the things that I've just observed watching the game is that it always occurred to me that a lot of the helmet contact seemed almost unavoidable because the game is just so fast. You may be going in low to hopefully make contact with your shoulder pads, but if at the last minute the player you're tackling, you know, takes a dip, you could end up catching the head. But as I've watched the game since they've been tougher on the rules, it's remarkable to me that these guys are such great athletes. They can actually avoid using their helmet if they're thinking about it, right?
No, you're absolutely right. That's a great observation. To address the first part, you're right. It is, there's going to be a ton of accidental helmet-to-helmet contact. I mean, if I was out there right now trying to tackle Michael Vick, when I got within 3 feet of him and I thought I was going to hit him a certain way, the fact is he's such a great athlete, he can move his head 4 feet from where I thought I was going to hit him. And the problem is it might end up, where I was going and it might not. And so as a player, people find out that if you pick a side, if you say, okay, I'm not going to go straight at his head, I'm going to go after one shoulder, it makes it harder to tackle him because you're exposing one side of your body and he can run that way and avoid you. And so it's a tough situation for defenders and blockers to be in because the safest way to make sure you catch some of somebody is to aim right for their middle. When you watch these defensive backs going after wide receivers across the middle in slow motion, you're seeing them put their head, just 6 inches over from where it used to be, and suddenly the hit's clean and everyone gets up and they keep playing rather than having to get a cart to wheel somebody off because you went helmet to helmet.
We're speaking with Christopher Nowinski, who's been an activist to reduce head injuries in football and other sports. He's also the author of the book Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis. Tell us a little more about this brain bank and how it works, what you're looking at.
Sure. We Sports Legacy Institute partnered with Boston University in 2008 to start the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy, and with that is a brain bank under the watch of Dr. Ann McKee. Ann McKee's been a neuropathologist for years and has a brain bank of about 1,000 brains, and I said, well, we're going to start getting you the brains of athletes and start looking at CTE. And so what's been great is partially because of the publicity and partially because we work very hard, we've been able to acquire the brains of 57 athletes since we started in 2008, including nearly 30 football players, boxers, hockey players, pro wrestlers. And so we're finally getting understanding as to what is going on inside the brains of athletes, and it really is telling us that we've been extremely reckless and we need to change things.
If a layman looks at a brain that's had this chronic traumatic damage, does it look different than a normal brain?
Depends how advanced it is. If it's a young person that's passed away, no. Grossly, it'll look the same. If it's an older person, for example, a Hall of Famer, Lou Kriegmer, NFL player, died at 82, it's smaller. It's much smaller, and the ventricles in the middle are much larger just because the brain has lost so much mass from cells dying. We can't diagnose this disease in living people right now, so we have to look at them after death. And the only disease you can really see is when you look under a microscope. When you look cell by cell, you see a toxic protein called tau that is slowly choking the cell to death. Essentially, it used to be part of the structure of the axon. The swelling from the injury probably caused it to fall apart and start to behave abnormally. And cause degeneration in the brain. So you see these, they actually paint the tissue with an antibody that turns the toxic tau protein brown. So you see these brown splotches on a microscopic level, cell by cell. And in some places, in some of these brains, you will see more dead or dying or diseased cells then you see living cells in parts of the brain that control things like memory and emotional control. And so it really is no surprise that these players suffer so greatly because their brain, you know, it's literally falling apart.
Before I let you go, are you still experiencing symptoms?
I am not experiencing the headaches anymore. I don't have the sleepwalking anymore. My short-term memory is actually pretty good. And so I think I'm out of the woods when it comes to post-concussion syndrome. The problem is I have to be concerned that chronic traumatic encephalopathy is in my future because 90% of the guys in our brain bank who have had the same brain trauma exposure that I have CTE. And so when they got into their late 30s and 40s, their short-term memory started disappearing. They started developing impulse control issues. They started developing mood disorders and depression. And so I am keenly aware that every time I overreact to something, that I don't know if that's just me or I don't know if my brain is slowly falling apart. And so I deal with that, and I try to pour that energy into the work that we're doing so we can eventually have a treatment for people like me and then maybe a cure.
Let me ask one more question. If you tell young players what the risks are and count on them making intelligent decisions, it's got to be tough. If you're in your 20s and the rewards include playing on Sunday in front of 70,000 screaming fans, making a ton of money, becoming a celebrity, a lot of people will take all kinds of risks, won't they?
You know, it's a great question. I'm glad you brought it up. I'm a big believer that adults with informed consent can do any dangerous job they want. I mean, look at me. I used to go through tables off the top rope on your average Friday night as my career. I thought it was great. The issue here is not – so I don't begrudge players that as long as they've been told this information and say, you know what, I'm going to take the risks because it's worth $10 million to me and will set up my family for the rest of my life – I'm okay with that. The problem is that 95% of the players that are playing football are under 18, and there's no such thing as informed consent for children on this issue. And so, we have to give them a chance by educating them, and then we have to force them to adhere to responsible medical practices by sitting out and letting their brain recover. And separating the kids' game of football from the adult game of football is something that we need to do going forward. I mean, I think when you step back and you hear old baseball players say they're lucky that they're adults that get to play a kids' game, I think of football the opposite way. And I think that we have kids playing an adults' game, and we need to separate what those two games are because, you can't throw away a kid's future just to have a little fun on after school and on the weekends.
Well, Christopher Nowinski, it's really been interesting, and I wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Christopher Nowinski is the author of the book Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis, and president of the Sports Legacy Institute, a nonprofit working to fight brain trauma in athletes. You can find a link on our website, freshair.npr.org. The Tucson shootings have many people examining the intensity of our political rhetoric. Do violent metaphors spark violent acts? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg isn't sure, but he says that isn't the point.
Sarah Palin was right. It was irresponsible for people to say that she had anything to do with the Tucson shootings. I'm not sure why she had to bring blood libel and the persecution of the medieval Jews into it, but she certainly could say it was a bum rap. But people kept talking about political rhetoric, even after the facts came out. For some, it was just an opportunity to bash the right. But most people were worried about the continuing potential for violence. In polls, the majority of Americans said that the tone of debate has become so inflammatory that it could push people over the edge. It's hard to prove that connection. There are more threats on politicians on both sides now, but not a lot of people are unhinged enough to actually try to carry out attacks. And once somebody's that far gone, he could be getting his marching orders from anywhere, Fox News, Grand Theft Auto, or the planet Romulus. But these attacks are disturbing even when they can't be directly linked to the language and symbols of political debate. How can you not be brought up short when a congresswoman is shot after she's been targeted on a campaign map with a crosshair? It's the feeling you'd have if you told somebody, oh, drop dead, and then 2 days later he keeled over with a fatal heart attack. Not that you caused it or even wished it, but all of a sudden your words are rumbling with their literal meaning. The Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz famously said that war is the continuation of politics by other means. But to listen to the way we talk, the opposite is true as well. The language of politics is, you should excuse the expression, shot through with martial imagery, with its campaigns, war rooms, battleground states, political bombshells, and attack ads. And that's not to mention the linguistic carnage that pervades our everyday speech, catch flak, take no prisoners, crash and burn. But it takes a violent event like Tucson to make people self-conscious about this language. 9/11 had the same effect. For a few months, we were all monitoring our words for any hint of semantic mayhem. I recall just after the attacks, listening to the San Francisco Giants announcer Mike Kruko describing the replay of a monster homer by Andres Galarraga. Boy, he said, he really hit that one good. Some people argue that purging our speech of all these metaphors would make us kinder, gentler conversationalists. Instead of saying she shot down his arguments, why don't we say she unraveled them or danced them into a corner? That was presumably what Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree had in mind when she urged the Republicans to remove the word killing from the name of what they're calling the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. This didn't make a lot of sense to me at first. In that context, the word kill doesn't conjure up any violent images, no more than it does when we talk about killing the lights, a deal, a bottle of scotch, or a couple of hours between flights. In fact, the proliferation of these denatured metaphors is really a tribute to the civilizing process as we sublimate our aggression into more pacific channels. Still, House Speaker John Boehner started to replace job-killing with job-destroying and job-crushing in his remarks. Those weren't exactly nonviolent alternatives, but there's a point to the gesture anyway. Once you start being careful about these dead metaphors, you're apt to be more circumspect about the ones that still have some blood running through their veins. The fact is that we no sooner domesticate one figure of speech than somebody introduces another to evoke a vivid image of combat. When fire away gets tired, you can go to lock and load. And while a crosshair may function much like a target, it isn't so tame that you can use it as the symbol of a discount store. For that matter, there's a difference between telling supporters at a fundraiser not to be outgunned and telling them, if they bring a knife, you bring a gun. The message doesn't change, but the adrenaline level does. It's a strength of the modern political culture that these apocalyptic metaphors no longer rouse people to armed insurrection. But then indignation has never had so many recreational outlets before. We can spend all our waking hours listening to broadcast political invective or writing sarcastic blog comments to excoriate the morons on the other side. That's the dirty little secret of political vituperation. Left and right, we all like to go there. But even if these violent reveries are almost never acted out, they coarsen the debate and dehumanize the other side. In fact, the scenarios behind those fantasies go a long way toward creating the so-called climate of hate. If you're going to imagine yourself riding to the rescue of the Republic, you're going to need to see your opponents as nefarious alien life forms. You put on a cowboy suit, and suddenly everybody else is an Indian.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. You can follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.